So for this evening's talk, again, another suggestion for talks, so please don't give me too many. We've already got enough to go on with for a while. And that was a very good question. Just how do we live in a world when the people we live with and associate with haven't got any ethics, or are they ethically challenged? And how can we have our ethics when other people don't? And it's not a question which, as a monk, I don't know about, because, yeah, I do live in a monastery and there are really good people who stay there, but sometimes we get some scallywags come into the monastery and you have to deal with builders, with workers, you go outside and just have to get things for the monastery in the shops. You know, you have to go travelling, you do meet so many people, you go into prisons and jails, so you do meet people from all different walks of life as a monk. You know, we're not secluded in the sense of a walled community where you never go out into the world. So you do get burnt sometimes with people who don't have any ethics at all. So I can understand what it's like. You know, as a monk, it happens rarely, but out there in the world, you try to do what's right, you try to do what's good, you try to keep, you know, your precepts and your high standards, but other people don't. Are you disadvantaged? Or what should you do? But of course, the first thing which I wanted to bring up on that question is the whole idea of ethics anyway, because if you're going to keep ethics, at least you have to know what ethics are. But you know you do anyway. This is a very powerful little teaching. I think I got this from the monk Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. You don't need to be a Christian, a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Jew, or a secularist. Every human being has an understanding of what's right and what's wrong. And the trouble is that when we're told, when we read the books, when we think too much, sometimes it all gets confused. And what too many people in our world do, they don't believe what they know is right. They just believe what the book says. They believe what some other person says. They just give away their authority. And that is something which is very dangerous in any religion. And please, in this place, don't give authority to me or to any other monk or nun or anybody who actually comes up here and tells you something. We're never, ever going to tell you what to do in this place. We're going to tell you how to find out, how to discover for yourself. So the authority will never be the monk, will never be the Buddha. The authority will be you. And the whole point of this meditation is getting you in contact with your inner world, becoming mindful and fully aware, so you can actually know what is right and what is wrong, their inner ethics. And I say that if you trust that, to trust that feeling inside, you know this is good, and sometimes, no, this is dodgy, this is bad. That is far more trustworthy than anything you read in any book, even Buddhist books. It will be more reliable than anything you hear in this talk or any other talk given here or elsewhere. The whole point is letting you get in touch with what you know is the standard for right and wrong. So first of all, please don't look for ethics in experts. Experts have ruined the whole world. Religions, I'm talking about religious books, have confused the hell out of people. The problem is that we believe in that stuff. So please, don't believe in the books. Believe in your heart. That is where those teachings really lie. That's what you should read. That's what you should contemplate. And if you do that, there's something in a human being which knows what's right, what's wrong. The classic story of that was when I was a young monk, still the Vietnam War. So this is the historical era when I grew up. And of that great war, there was one terrible war crime, and that was the My Lai Massacre, where a group of American soldiers went into a village with the orders to kill every man, woman, and child in that village of My Lai in Vietnam, because they thought that it was a hotbed of the communist people who were fighting the Americans. So that was an order at war. Eventually, a journalist discovered the massacre, reported it, and it was obviously a big scandal through the newspapers of the world. The commanding officer, a Lieutenant Kelly, was put on trial, was giving a military trial, and was found guilty and put in jail, and then was given an amnesty by, I think, President Nixon, I think it was, which was a little bit unfair. But recently somebody told me an enterprising TV crew did a follow-up documentary, it must have been like 30 years after my life, to try and find out what happened to those soldiers who went into that village, and also what happened to some of the survivors of that great massacre, that great war crime. And of course, the interesting thing was, as a Buddhist, what's the karmic effect of you following an order to do something which is obviously very unethical and wrong? And as I would have expected, being a Buddhist, as I would have known, being an amateur psychologist by being a meditator, just about all of those people who went into that village shooting and killing men, women, and children, even babies, had huge social disorders and psychological problems. Standard things like not being able to have a relationship with a partner, not being able to hold down a job, not being able to have a successful and happy life, being addicted to drugs, suicidal, and all sorts of other sort of disorders. They were not balanced. But as usual, there is always an exception. And that exception just emphasizes the point. They found one black African-American soldier, who had actually refused the order and was sent to military jail as a consequence. He refused to go into that village. And they interviewed this guy, and apparently that he was just a person who was born in the poor parts of some city, who joined the army just to get away out of drugs and poverty, to get a life, basically. And he joined the army there. He had not much education. But when it came to the point of being ordered in to shoot men, women, and children, he said he couldn't do that. He refused, even though he knew the consequences would be 3 or 4 years in a military prison, which is much worse than a civilian prison in the United States. So he knew the consequences, but he said he had to say no. And of course, as you would expect, of all of those people they followed up, he was the only one who was at peace with himself, in a good relationship, happy, successful. But the point of that story, which when they told it to me, this was the crucial part. They asked him, why did you refuse? Even though you knew the consequences were going to be 3 or 4 years in a terrible military jail. Now, are you religious? And he said, no, I'm not religious. Are you a philosopher? I'm not a philosopher. I hardly had any education. Well, why? How did you do that? He said, because I knew in here it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. I just couldn't do it. And I think probably because he didn't have an education to actually confuse his inner ethical compass, because he didn't have a religion to tell him what was right and what was wrong, he could rely on what everybody should rely upon, that inner little meter of right and wrong, what you feel in your heart. And if you follow that, then you will know what is right and what is wrong. And that is by far the most trustworthy. Even these Buddhist 5 precepts which we teach here, there are some times when it's right to break them. And I say that, and I'm sure that some people are already just getting on that chat box and saying, Ajahn Brahm, what are you saying? You're encouraging people to be unethical. The classic story, again, was one of the very early members of our Buddhist society, I don't think I don't mind talking about him now, Don Clark. And he's an English guy. He was in the British Navy, came to Perth, fell in love with the place while he was in the Navy, and retired here with his wife and brought up kids. A great guy. But he had a heart attack and was rushed to Royal Perth Hospital. This is many years ago. And, of course, you know, being a good friend, not just a disciple, these are friends, I went to see him immediately. And he told me what had happened. He survived the heart attack, but he was going to have a bypass operation in the days of bypasses before the stents. He was in a ward with three other men, four men in this ward. I remember going in one of those wards once, and four guys in one room, long enough, they get up to very stupid things. And I put my hand up. We were having this conversation when I was in this hospital many, many years ago with three other guys, and a conversation, what's the worst medical procedure? And somebody said one thing, somebody said another, and this guy said, no, that's nothing. The worst is a barium enema. Don't get a barium enema. That's the worst, the most uncomfortable, unpleasant thing. And this poor guy in the other bed went white. He said, I'm going to have that this afternoon. Guys can be very stupid when they're together in one room, even if there's a monk amongst them. But anyway, in this room, they were talking together, and he got friends with Jack in one of the other beds. And Jack was in there before him, was going to have the bypass that afternoon, or that tomorrow, the next day. And that evening, or the next evening, his wife called me at monastery. She was very concerned. And I asked him, is Don okay? Is he all right? And he said, no, he's all right. It's me, she said, because I've just lied to my husband. And she said, and this is, I remember this pretty accurately, she said, this is the first time I've lied to my husband in 37 years since we got married, or maybe before. We've always told the truth to each other. Because when I went to the hospital, and I saw Jack's widow outside. Jack had died in the operation. As sometimes it happens when you have a bypass. I think it's a 10% death rate. He died. And when I went in to see my husband, he asked me, how was Jack after his operation? I lied to him. I said he was in the ICU recovering. He was fine. Because I thought, said his wife, if I told my husband that his friend had died this afternoon from the same operation he's having tomorrow, the fear may have killed him. And she said, I feel so bad. And I said, listen, I think that's one time it was the right thing to lie to your husband. And I love telling that story because he did come very, very close to death. He was hallucinating in the ICU for many days after his bypass. He pulled through. He lived. But only just. And I think, seeing what had actually happened, if she had told the truth to her husband that a fellow he'd got to be friends with died from the same operation he was going to have the next day, that fear could have pushed him over the edge and killed him. So I said it was okay. And I say this in public, it is okay to lie. Only once in 37 years. But no more than that. And the point is, I said, great, because you felt that was the right thing to do. You knew that was the right thing to do. But if you follow the books and the theories and the religions and all those sorts of things, that is what confuses you. It's wrong because the monk said it was wrong, or the book said it was wrong. My religion says it's wrong, but you know it's right. What should you do? Always follow what's right inside of you. That is much more fundamental. The religions, the precepts, all these talks, they just elaborate on something which you should know yourself. So that is really your ethics. And my own little story, as many of you know, Dennis knows this one because he was there at the time. There was one of the things, and I don't mind saying I'm proud of this. That was a time when I was in the monastery where I grew up, and there was this moment. Because of the bhikkhuni ordination, they told me, if you say those four women at Dharmasara are not bhikkhunis, then there'll be no more problem. But if you keep on saying they are bhikkhunis, you'll be expelled. And I knew that was going to be a serious problem for myself, the other monks, and our Buddhist society, separating, you know, me from my friends I've grown up with, which I still love and care for, separating that. But then I looked inside, and there's no way, no way could I do what I knew what was wrong. So I said, I'm sorry, but they're bhikkhunis, they're nuns. So they expelled me. And now I'm proud of that. I remember at the time saying that if I took the opposite course, I'd never be able to live myself. That's unethical. I just can't live with a lack of ethics, doing what I know is wrong. No way I can do that. But the only way I could have done that by being fully mindful inside, mindful of those feelings, and that was my indicator, what was ethical and what was not ethical. Now, that is how you can deal in life in a world which is sometimes not ethical. If you are always going to follow what other people say, and sometimes it's not even wise people, sometimes it's the boss, sometimes it's your peers, sometimes your friends, sometimes your enemies, or just sometimes an acquaintance, and you look for them, for your ethics, you will just be taken down a path where you make more and more mistakes. One of the reasons why I could stand up and why other people stand up for what they know is right is because they do put aside the books. They do put aside their teachers. They do put aside all they've been taught and known. And they do look inside here. That's where you get your strength from. That is where you can say, no, this is wrong, I will not do it. No matter what other people say. Your ethics become powerful in a world where other people may punish you, put you in jail for you standing up for what you know is the correct thing to do. You follow that. Now, as you're following your ethics, sometimes it does hurt. Sometimes you do get blamed. But when I get blamed for anything I do, when you get blamed for things you do, I always keep in mind a very simple teaching of Ajahn Chah. Simple, but the simple teachings are always the best because you remember them. He used to say many times, because he lived in the world as well, he was often criticized, as you're criticized, blamed, as you're blamed. People sometimes misunderstand and say you're a bad girl, you're a bad monk, you're a bad husband, you're a bad kid or whatever. They blame you. Are you going to change what you know is right to follow them just to get their compliments or their praise or even their friendship? No, you don't. If they blame you, Ajahn Chah would always say, if they call you a dog, look at your bottom. Remember this. If you call you a dog, look at your bottom. If you see there's a tail there, then you're a dog. Say thank you, you're right. If you can't find a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. It's a beautiful saying. They call you a dog, look if you've got a tail. What that means is if they criticize you, if they blame you, if they challenge your ethics, then you have to investigate. Don't just ignore them. They're stupid. What do they know? Now, they're not wise like me. They're not a monk. You know, they're only a sort of a Christian, a Muslim or something. What do they know? No, that's really arrogant. Doesn't matter who they are. They may be saying something which is really important to you. You may learn that, yes, you have made a mistake. Look to see if you've made a mistake. They called you a dog. Look if you've got a tail. And look honestly. And if they have pointed out something, thank you. Because the purpose in life is not being right. It's becoming better, wiser, more compassionate. No one is ever finished with their job in life. No one is ever perfect, right, wise, compassionate, fully developed. We're growing. So when someone gives us some advice and we can make use of it to become a better person, thank you. But you know, a lot of times, most times, when people call me a dog, I've looked down there, there hasn't been a tail at all. So I'm sorry, you're wrong. And when you know yourself that you've done nothing wrong, your ethics are very pure, of course, then their criticisms, their lack of ethics, they don't move you at all. The only reason why they sometimes move you and influence you when you do something you think is right and other people say it's wrong, you're going to the wrong place, going to this Buddhist society, you will go to hell if you keep coming down here, this is the wrong path, you must believe in Jesus, you must believe in this, you must believe in that, you must believe in the pub, you must believe in the cricket, whatever else the religions of this world are. But no. If you follow books, if you follow talks, you haven't got the strength to resist. But if you look in your heart, you look in your bottom to see if you've got a tail. I say, no, I don't want to do that. No, that's wrong. This is right. That's where you get the strength from. And it's so important in our modern world for people to actually have that strength of ethics, that inner strength. And it's not something which a religion can tell you what is right and what is wrong. The job of religion is to tell you how to find out and how to trust that, to believe in that rather than in the words. A few weeks ago, I talked about the difference between the container and the contents. The container is the books, the Buddhas, it's the talks, it's the words. The contents is what's inside the books. What does the statue actually mean? In this talk, what is the monk really trying to get at? Find the contents, and I think you've got the contents. You get in contact with your heart, with mindfulness, and there you find the ethical compass. And when you find that, that is strong enough to resist. But it's not just having ethics. It's not just having compassion. Because sometimes that's the most important part of ethics, is to be kind. But the wisdom has to come with compassion. Because sometimes, yeah, I'm being kind, but, as I often say, you must also be kind to yourself as well. You also count. One of the sayings we used to chant again and again and again and again when I was a young monk in Thailand, may all beings be happy and well. And I think of all the beings, all the people in the world, all the insects, all the animals, all the cats, the birds, everything in the whole world, even the invisible beings. May all beings be happy and well. I thought, what a wonderful thought. Until someone pointed out, you're forgetting someone. Yourself. And how easy it is to be compassionate to all other beings. But you must also be compassionate to yourself as well. And to make it very clear, there's a story which I haven't told for years. So it's a great opportunity to put up this very simple story about ethics in this little talk. It's a story of the robbers and the seven monks. If you heard this story before, I really want you to be quiet because I'm going to ask you all a question at the end of this story. I haven't done this for a couple of years now. There were seven monks meditating in a cave. And listen carefully who these seven monks were. There was the head monk, number one. The second monk was his brother. They had become a monk as well. The third monk was his best friend. They'd all become monks together. The fourth monk was actually his enemy. Even though they were both monks together, they just had like personality clash that sometimes happens. They didn't get on together. You know that sometimes in life. They're really good people. They just can't get on. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was actually so old, he was at the end of his life. He could die any day. And the next monk, number six, he was very ill. In fact, he was always so ill that he was on the edge of life and death as well. And no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the final monk, number seven, was the useless monk. You know, he couldn't chant in key. He couldn't even remember the chants. His robe was always falling off. Oops, that's me. He couldn't give a good talk. When he gave a talk, people would fall asleep. And even when he meditated, he would fall asleep. And it's called the useless monk. As I often say, every monastery or nunnery has one. I won't tell you who they are, though. But so the seven monks, and they were in this cave, they were meditating on loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well, free of suffering, whatever, whatever. And this band of thieves, they discovered that cave in the forest. And straight away they thought, wow, this would be a great hideout for us. a place where we can get all of our stolen goods, put them in this cave and hide from the police until the heat goes down. But they thought, the monks are in here first. And if we let them go, one of them, I'm sure, will tell the police. So let's kill them all. So these really bad people wanted to kill all those monks. But there was a head monk. And that head monk, he was such a good talker. You know, they always say, you know, you could sell ice to Eskimos. That he managed to talk these bandits, these thieves, into letting all the monks go except one. One would have to be sacrificed as a warning to show that, you know, these thieves meant business. And if any of those monks said anything, these thieves would actually catch them eventually and do the same to them. And that was the very, very best the head monk could do. So he was left with this terrible, terrible choice to decide which monk would have to be sacrificed so all the other monks could go free. Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask you, which monk did that head monk decide to sacrifice? But I have to go through the list again, so listen carefully. There was a head monk, was number one. There was his brother, his best friend, his enemy he didn't like anyway. This old monk who was going to die any time. Same with the sick monk. They were both at the end of their life. And lastly, the useless monk throughout his whole career had never really done anything for anybody. So, if you know the answer, please be quiet. So who did the head monk decide to sacrifice? Any suggestions?
Himself.
Does anyone agree with that? Put your hand up if you think himself. Come, be honest. Okay, you are all wrong. That's why I love doing this. It's embarrassing. That's the wrong answer. Any other suggestions? It's not himself. Any other suggestions?
The old monk?
No, that's wrong. The useless monk, no, he always gets a mention. I don't know why. I'll stop it now, because the answer is, and when I first heard this, I think, wow, that's a very powerful, deep story. The answer is he couldn't choose. These are always trick questions. If ever I ask you a question, keep your hands down. You'll always get it wrong. It's a trick question. Because his love towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love towards his best friend. He even loved his enemy the same. May all beings be happy and well, even my enemy. And even the old monk, the sick monk, even the poor old useless monk, he loved everyone totally equally. And most importantly, and this is the main reason I tell this story, and why most people first of all say, yes, he sacrificed himself, which is the wrong answer. He loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. Even in Christianity, the golden rule is to love your neighbor as yourself, which means to love yourself as your neighbor. No more, no less. Understand? To love everybody, including yourself. And why is it we sacrifice ourselves when we would never sacrifice somebody else? That actually shows us there is a mistake there in the way that we look at even ethics. The reason is because you've been taught that since you were a child. Sacrifice is noble. You don't sacrifice. You look at yourself no more, no less than all other beings. You find your place in this world alongside, not superior, not inferior, with all other beings. And if you can understand that, then you understand one of the reasons why people have no ethics. Or rather, ethics are not working. You've got to look after yourself as you look after others. And by the way, before someone asks me as a question, what happened as a result of that answer is actually based on a story in the Theragata called the Thalaputta Sutta. I've taken great liberties with that sutta. It's not quite the same as I told you a few moments ago. In fact, it's quite different, but the essence is the same. Those bandits, when they heard this monk's answer, they were so impressed with the wisdom of that head monk that they all stopped being bandits, and half of them became monks themselves. Isn't that a lovely end to the story? So anyway, back to the point of telling this story. When other people aren't keeping ethics, compassion means you have to look after yourself and protect yourself as well. Sometimes the people who are Buddhists think, oh no, just compassion to other beings. We forget about ourselves, which is sometimes why in a world without ethics we get hurt. So please protect yourself. And be real, be wise to know that not everybody is going to be wise and kind to you. Not everybody comes to Dhammaloka Buddhist Center on a Friday night or listens on the internet. There are going to be some people who are very confused, who believe their books, who believe what they're said, believe their conditioning, believe their peers. Oh, it's a dog-eat-dog world and I'm going to get mine first and just to hell with yours. That sort of idea is current in many people, so you've got to protect yourself sometimes. Protect yourself is just mean being practical. And a way to protect yourself is the standard Buddhist story, which I'll say very quickly, is once there was a snake, and the snake became a Buddhist because he was afraid of what's going to happen to him when he dies. And so he decided to become a Buddhist. He took the five precepts, so the snake decided he wouldn't kill anybody anymore. And he was starting to be abused by some kids who thought he was just a weakling. First of all, they started just saying bad words to him, saying, you're not a real snake. You're just an oversized worm. You're a slimy creep. You know, all sorts of words which, you know, really upset. You know, proud. I'm a snake. I'm not a worm. But the snake couldn't bite them, because that would kill them. So the snake couldn't protect himself. And because of that, the boys started hitting him with sticks and throwing stones at him. And he thought these five precepts, especially not being allowed to bite someone, meant he had no protection whatsoever. And he thought these five precepts, yeah, they may be okay when you're in a monastery or in a temple, but out there in the world, you've got to protect yourself, so you can't be so ethical. And so he went up to the monk who gave him those precepts. He said, look what you've done to me. And I've been all beaten up and bruised and bloody because of you. And the monk says, not because of me, because you're a stupid snake, that's why. What do you mean I'm a stupid snake? Look, said the monk, I told you not to bite, but I never told you not to hiss. And that's all a snake needs to do to protect himself. If a snake, there was a big snake on JR's path for the last couple of days, or the last 24 hours or whatever.
Half a day,
yeah, big snake. But, you know, he just had to be there to make sure that, you know, this monk just made a big detour around him. You don't need to bite as a snake to sort of get respect. Maybe hiss every now and again. That's all you need to do. And that's the same. Now, the compassionate protecting yourself. If it's a boss at work, if it's another person you're, you know, you associate with and they give you a hard time, back. And you're still keeping your ethical precepts. You're not hurting them, you're just protecting yourself. So remember, don't be stupid. In a world without much ethics, sometimes you have to hiss now and again. But sometimes you think, well, if that's all we can do, I still get taken advantage of. But my experience, and I'm sure many other people's experience too, is if you do hold your ethical line, maybe at first you may lose, but in the long term you always win. I really believe in the law of karma. Every time I practice that law of karma, I've seen it work. When you do take an ethical stand, when other people aren't, you do stand your ground. This is right. This is what I'm going to do. I am not going to sort of break precepts and harm other people. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to care for them. I'm going to do the right thing. You do get an advantage. So often, look, one story which comes to mind. Now, those of you who've been around here a long time, those of you who've been to see the monasteries, the retreat center, the, you know, nuns monastery, know that most of those buildings were built by the monks. we worked very hard. And so we also had to go to the hardware store. We had accounts there to get things, you know, for building the monastery. That's where we went shopping, you know, to Bunnings, Collies, the hardware store, all these places. I remember going there once and getting a huge amount of wood for one of the monks' huts I was building. And, you know, putting it all in the trolley, when I took it back to Bodhinyana Monastery, I realized that by mistake, there's about 3 pieces of wood I hadn't paid for. And it was just a mistake, just because we were putting it in and I was distracted. I checked with the invoice, the receipt, we hadn't paid for it. Next day I went in there and said, look, I'm terribly sorry, but, you know, we had this yesterday and we didn't pay for it. So, you know, we've got the driver with me. He's got some money actually to pay the extra. I always remember the guy who was looking after us. He looked at me and he just stopped speaking. He looked at me just blank. And so I thought he didn't understand me. I said, look, no, we got this wood yesterday, remember? We haven't paid for it, so here's the extra. And then without saying anything, he put it in the till and just did the buttons, whatever. He said, just wait here a moment. He went up to see his boss, and the boss came down and said, okay, Buddhist Society of Western Australia, you've got a trade account here, 10% off on everything you buy. And we still got that account today at this big hardware store. And that's about 20 years now we've had that account. We still save thousands of dollars, you know, on all the stuff we bought from that place, just because once, you know, we were totally honest, and it surprised them. So these guys, you know, are honest, they're ethical. And because of that, we've got this huge financial advantage. That's happened so many times. If you're ethical, you get business advantage. And the other story, which I'm going to bring up now, one of the people I know of in Sydney, he had some big business, I forget exactly what, but he was negotiating this contract with some big company in Taiwan. And, you know, it got to the point they were negotiating over the phone and by emails. It got to the point they had to sign the contract. So a couple of the directors came over from Taiwan. He met them in Sydney, sort of took them out for lunch, and then they sort of looked at the contract, you know, started just the final negotiations, only small things, say, okay, we're ready to sign. But they said, we'll sign this evening. They said, we want you, you know, as a host, to take us, you know, to the pub, you know, for free alcohol, and afterwards to take us to a brothel in Sydney for girls. And then we'll sign a contract. And this is a true story. This guy told me this. And this guy said, look, no, I don't do that. I've got a wife. And I love my wife. I'm not going to sort of, you know, have any prostitutes. And also, I'm a Buddhist. I don't drink. So I don't want to do this. And these business people come all the way from Taiwan, got very upset and angry, say, look, if you don't do this, there's no contract. We won't sign it. And so he too, he told me he had this decision. This was worth, you know, a huge amount of money for his company, you know, multi-million. Now, should I just bend my ethics just for one night for this money? I was so proud of him, he said, no, I won't do this. He said, I'm sorry, the deal's off. And he went home to his wife. And I'm just so proud of him that, you know, he realized he had a wife, that was all I want. Now, she's a person I love, I'm committed to. I'm not going to break my marriage for this contract, and I'm not going to let these other people do it. And he was willing to sacrifice so much. So he said he was very depressed that night because his company was in difficulty without that contract. But late at night, he got a call from the Taiwanese business people. Are you still up? Can you come to the pub? He said, well, no, I don't want to drink. He said, no, we understand you don't like to drink, but we're discussing you. We decided that it's much better that we do business with someone who doesn't cheat on his wife than he's unlikely to cheat on us. And someone who is, you know, so ethical that they will not sort of bend their ethics just for money. You're the sort of person we can trust. We want to do business with you. Come to the pub, we'll sign it straight away. And he got his contract signed. And he stood his ground to do that. I love telling that story because doesn't that make sense? Now, if you're doing business, who do you want to do business with? Someone who's got no ethics or who's willing to bend their ethics for a bit of money. They'll cheat you sooner or later. Or do you want to do business with someone who doesn't bend, who is trustworthy, reliable? Doesn't it make sense? Those are the people to do business with. So if you keep ethics in an unethical world, you actually get the advantage in the long term. You get to be the person who is employed because you are trustworthy, reliable, who doesn't cheat. You can be trusted, you know, with money, with big contracts, because they know that you have shown you've got ethical strength. That is why there are many people who don't keep ethics. But if you decide not to be one of those, but someone who knows inside of you, trusts in that, stands up for that, then you find, yes, you may lose many battles in your life, but you'll win the war for sure. You will become successful because you get to be known as a person who's strong and can be trusted. And the best part of all, because I keep coming back to this, but you are going to die one day. And just before you die, you do look at your life, what you've done, why you've done it. And if you have stuck to your principles, to your ethics, you've done what you thought was good. You really have been strong there and haven't bent. Then you will die very peacefully, very happy. If you believe in a life after, wonderful. You always get a great rebirth. And if you don't, you become an inspiration for others. You become like the Mandelas of this world, like the Martin Luther Kings. Maybe not so big, but you do inspire the people who come after us. And if we really want to leave a legacy, to make sure that our life in this planet is not wasted, that is a legacy we need to leave. Yeah, there are people with little ethics in this world, but don't be one of them. Then you can actually raise this world. When people do have ethics, there's a huge amount we can do to solve all these problems in this world, which usually come when people do sacrifice what they know is good just for what they can make money out of, or what they can get pleasure out of, what they can get power out of. But if you're not one of those and keep your ethics, follow what you know is right, you won't be one of those. You'll be one who makes this world a much better place. And whether it's with global warming or peace between nations and religions or whatever the many problems of this world are, which really do need solving, we do need people who take that stand. In here you'll find that stand. Thank you for listening.